Welcome to the podcast.ua with Tinka
and Vadim. This podcast is dedicated to Ukrainian studies.
We conduct interviews with scholars from the UNDIPUS project,
which stands for Undisciplined Pluralizing Ukrainian Studies, Understanding the War in Ukraine.
Join us on the .ua podcast. And today we have our guest here, Dr. Olga Plahotnik, and we will talk about sexual citizenship in Ukraine. Olga, may I introduce you briefly? Since 2022, you have been a researcher and the coordinator of the UNDIPUS project here in the beautiful small city of Greifswald. And you work at the intersection of several broad fields of research. These are feminist studies, citizenship studies, post-colonial and decolonial analysis, post-socialism and Eastern Europe, and also anti-oppressive pedagogies. And it's very interesting because you have access from different perspectives to these fields because you have several professions. So you earned, for example, your first diploma in psychology in Kharkiv. Later, also in Ukraine, you received a candidate of science in social philosophy. And you did another master degrees in sociology and gender studies in Lithuania. And you did your PhD in sociology in the UK, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's a lot. and this was just briefly about your biography. And what about your scientific past? Is there something you want to add, for example, something important which I missed maybe?
Yes. Thank you, Tinka. Thank you, Vadim, for inviting me. And thanks for the question. Indeed, I have moved across disciplines and borders a lot, and my academic trajectory wasn't straightforward. For example, I entered the MA program at the European Humanities University after I defended my PhD. So for many of my colleagues, it looked like a step back. But the reason was that I became very interested in gender studies and wanted to receive a good education in this subject. Also, 10 years after getting my first PhD in Ukraine, I entered another PhD program in the UK, and I also changed the discipline from philosophy to sociology, and I also challenged myself to do empirical sociological research. But if I use a sociological imagination and try to see generic patterns in my academic biography, there are some interesting moments. For example, it is linked to the labor migration from the peripheries to the centers. I do consider myself a labor migrant, an academic labor migrant, from a poorer peripheral country, Ukraine, to the academies of the global north. Well, of course, my academic professional path is more privileged than cleaning and care work typically performed by women from Ukraine, often with university degrees. And yet, academic work is very precarious nowadays, especially for migrants. It is very difficult, almost impossible to have a permanent position. I managed to stay in academia in Canada and Germany on temporary contracts, but I achieved this by doing more than one master and more than one PhD. This is quite a common situation for scholars from Ukraine to do a second master, a second PhD, etc. So basically, I had a job in Canada and now I have a job in Germany because I did my second PhD. That's the situation from a sociological perspective.
So you're working now a lot in the field of critical citizenship studies, which is for me a total new topic, especially when we're talking about concept of sexual citizenship. So maybe a lot of our listeners don't know more about it. So can you please tell us more about this topic and what is a sexual citizenship in general?
Good question. Yeah, I received it quite often. and many people whom I encounter and tell about my research say, oh, it sounds so interesting, but what is it? Right. So the notion of citizenship basically has two meanings, to simplify. The first meaning is legal, and it refers to the formal or formalized belonging of a person to a state through possession of a passport or another relevant ID. In bureaucratic language, it's also called nationality, so, right? What is your nationality? This meaning of citizenship relates to the verb be, to be or not to be. For example, are you a citizen of Germany? Tinka, are you a citizen of Germany?
Yes.
Adim, are you a citizen of Germany?
No.
No. Okay. I'm also not a citizen of Germany. So that's a legal meaning. The second meaning is much broader and more vague than the legal definition, because a real relationship between a person, their community, and a state are very complex and dynamic. There are a whole bunch of expectations and duties related to citizenship from both sides, from the state and from citizens. In this second approach, citizenship is not mere membership, but rather a political process. I would even say a performative political process of doing citizenship and becoming political subjects. And this process is being made simultaneously from above, like from the state agency and political leaders, and from below, from people and communities. In this sense, citizenship is a social institute. And when I say that I am doing critical citizenship studies and what I am doing, I mean a specific approach to this Institute of Citizenship that keeps in a permanent focus how power works. And from this perspective, citizenship is conceived as a political practice of constant differentiation between good or proper citizens, and those who are not or shouldn't be citizens. I can provide an example. In New Year's Eve 2023, the president of Ukraine urged the Ukrainians who fled the war abroad to return to Ukraine. And he said, literally, you must choose whom to be, a refugee or a citizen. In this sentence, the word citizen is used not as a legal category, because obviously people who fled the war from Ukraine still have Ukrainian passports, like they are like legal citizens. But what president meant was returning to Ukraine means being good or proper citizens of your country, right? It conveys the idea that if you're hiding from the war abroad, you cannot fully belong to the nation state. This is a very cynical example, actually. So there is a full theorizing of this tendency in academic literature. For example, Chantal Mouffe and other scholars argue that citizenship is always produced through and productive of its constitutive outside or constitutive others. So meaning those who do not deserve to be national subjects, right? So those others might be LGBT people or believers of some religious confessions or racialized people. So critical citizenship studies are focused on citizenship as this complex process of inclusion and exclusion, like who is included, who is excluded, by what means, under which reasoning, etc., etc. And finally, the central concept of my research is sexual citizenship, and it means a political practice of relationship building and negotiation between LGBT plus people and communities. And here I would like to unpack that this abbreviation concerns lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and gender non-conforming people and communities. And There is always a plus after letters, which means that the list is open. And the state. There are not so many studies on this topic with respect to Ukraine. And existing studies primarily focus on sexual and gender politics produced by the state and its institution. In other words, there are studies how sexual citizenship is being made from above. And for me, it is more interesting how sexual citizenship is made from below, from people and communities. My PhD dissertation on this topic is an extensive sociological, empirically based research. Its title is Imaginaries of Sexual Citizenship in Post-Maidan Ukraine. And it is available full text on the website of the Open University in the UK where I studied. So if you're interested, you may take a look.
Yeah, but could you please go on with sexual citizenship, especially in Ukraine? What is interesting there?
There are interesting things there, but I would like to provide a bit of context to our listeners who might not be familiar with Ukrainian situation in detail. By now, LGBT people, or LGBT plus, people in Ukraine are deprived of a number of rights and freedoms. In some spheres, they are discriminated against legally. For example, regarding the rights connected to marriage or adoption of children or custody. Also, the state doesn't protect LGBT people from homophobic and transphobic violence and hate speech, with rare exceptions. That is why the main agenda of LGBT activism today is about overcoming discrimination and receiving a complete set of rights and recognitions for LGBT people. So using my terminology, it means achieving full-fledged citizenship, right? Becoming first-class citizens. Epistemologically, this struggle is grounded in the assumption that LGBT activism is a single issue social movement focused on the needs and rights of their respective communities. It means, this is a sociological term which describes movement as it is concerned only with needs and problems of their LGBT people, right? Okay. I also would like to say a couple of words about my method, because it matters. In 2016-2017, when I collected my data in Ukraine, LGBT community centers operated in 7 Ukrainian cities. They were named queer homes. I visited all of them and organized collective discussions there. In sociology, this method is called focus group discussion. Participants of those meetings were very different people from different professional class, age groups. They also have different relationship with institutionalized activism. So some of them belonged to organizations, some of them didn't, and they have also different political views. And that is why the long collective discussion, typically with coffee or pizza, produced a wide range of opinions from community members. So people told very, very different stories and voiced very different views. And some opinions aligned with mainstream discourse, so they echoed public narratives of LGBT organizations and their leaders. But there were also other more critical opinions, more critical towards the mainstream strategies of LGBT activism, more critical towards the state and police and many other things. So this was my data, right? And when I collected and discursively analyzed those narratives, I identified the dominant discourse of sexual citizenship in Ukraine. This model is grounded, first of all, in the assumption that we should become good citizens first, that being good actually serves as a prerequisite for achieving rights and protection from the state. This is itself is a sort of problematic position which can be questioned, but I would like to move further. What does it mean to be a good citizen in Ukraine? On the one hand, it includes some common features described in the literature on sexual citizenship worldwide, such as being obedient citizens in a capitalist society, right? Workers and communities obey the law, obey the law and struggle for visibility and recognition of LGBT communities. It was one part. But remember, it was 2016-17. Crimea was already annexed by Russia and the war was already going on in Donbass. So that's why the Ukrainian model of sexual citizenship had a specific component, which is a strong patriotic position. The narratives included such claims as "we were on Maidan fighting for European values," and "we LGBT people are in the military now fighting for Ukraine." That was the dominant discourse of sexual citizenship at the time of my study. There were also counter discourses produced inside LGBT communities, statements that problematized this neoliberal and patriotic agenda. Those narratives were scattered across the spaces. Sometimes they emerged as placards at marches or other public events or in online discussions. Pride marches, especially Kyiv Pride, were always at the epicenter of those debates. And now let me remind you once again that we are talking about discussions inside LGBT communities, not between LGBT and homophobic or transphobic opponents, like so to say, right? And as for Pride marches, my co-author Maria Majerczyk and I analyzed those debates from a decolonial perspective and wrote a paper. It was published in Lambda Nordica Journal and under the title "Pride Contested: Geopolitics of Liberation at the Buffy Periphery of Europe." It's open access article if you're interested. And in this paper, we wanted to understand how the location of Ukraine on the fringes of two imperial formations, more specifically the global West and Russian imperialism, shapes LGBT politics and pride politics in particular, and how they inform the imaginary of sexual citizenship. So to conclude briefly, like good capitalist, neoliberal citizen and patriotic citizen. That's how the model looks like in Ukraine. Yeah.
Thank you, Olga. But imagine like someone is listening our podcast and might ask, what is wrong with like being a good citizen? Because I think majority want to be good citizens.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question and very, very challenging one. I would try to answer it in theory now. I will explain later why in theory. But this wouldn't be a pure theory also because, as I said, the narratives I collected from within LGBT communities actually contained already all these like critical statements towards the good citizens model. So it's not like people want to be good citizens and I'm approaching from outside with some academic, you know, snobbish criticism. It's like, it's there. It's there already in communities, right? Okay. When we think about good citizenship model, what's wrong with that from a critical perspective, there can be several lines of thoughts. One of them, for example, is most prominent in transgender studies. Dean Spade, a transgender scholar from the US, wrote several books arguing that when, well, it's about US, but we can sort of think about relevance of this criticism. When in the US, lesbian and gay people received a right, federal right to marry, in well, it was a moment when this advancement comes at the price for some other and much more vulnerable populations. In the US, those are people of color, especially transgender people of color, especially transgender women of color. And violence against transgender women of color is huge and not that much visible in media in comparison with celebration of gay marriage. So this idea that when some group receives rights and celebrate their rights, we should be careful and see who paid the price, right? That's one line of critique. And it also concerns the internal hierarchies inside LGBT communities. We all know that racial and gender and differentiations based on physical abilities and economic status are always there, right? Inside LGBT communities, even if people are united on the base of sexual orientation and gender identity, right? And transgender people are always more marginalized and more vulnerable under this seemingly uniting LGBT plus umbrella, right? Another line of criticism is that when some communities, well, LGBT communities, wants to be included in the state, wants to belong to all social institutes of the state, from this perspective, the state itself and social institutes look good and not questionable, right? And this concerns all aspects. For example, let's take marriage, right? So my research participants actually told me during focus group discussions, there were opinions that yes, we should receive marriage rights, we should be first class citizens, why we don't have them, right? And 20 minutes later, sometimes the same people voice it, but why on the earth I should inform the state with whom I live, with whom I share my bed, right? Why on the earth it defines so much for property rights, for rights to adopt children, for inheritance, etc., etc. So why should we belong to the Institute of Marriage, which actually emerged as a racist, capitalist, heterosexist and whatever, why should we belong to fight for belonging to it instead of dismantling this institution like at all? So that's the line of criticism, right? So At the same time, I totally recognize that citizenship as a set of feelings and attitudes is very sweet and luring. And it is very good feeling to belong to a group, to feel like you are a part of something big, and it's sweet. And in this sense, doing critical citizenship studies is not an easy task, because you sort of come as a killjoy right now.
Yes, thank you, Olga. As a queer person from Ukraine, I might say that it's very important questions, and it's very important topics to discuss. The extensive research you have told us about sexual citizenship, which took place several years ago, it was before the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So can you tell us how the big war changed LGBTQ plus communities and the configuration of sexual citizenship in Ukraine?
I will try. Of course, the full-scale war changed many lives and brought and continues to bring many deaths, much suffering, sorrow. The communities are often ruined as a result of displacement, right? Or trauma, and trauma. At the same time, the dominant model of sexual citizenship didn't change. On the contrary, this model became stronger and extremely polarized. I can provide an example, actually. Back in 2017, one of the specifically Ukrainian aspects of sexual citizenship was a strong tendency to lean politically towards the EU and even away from Russia, right? So it was actually the Maidan agenda, and this agenda completely corresponded with wishes and political aims of LGBT movement, because Russia was going into homophobic and transphobic state, and Ukraine sort of wanted to join the EU. And some research participants actually voiced this directly, that we LGBT people are now in a better position after Euromaidan, because now Russians are the main enemies, not we, right? So it was like that. And of course, this disposition has only strengthened after 2022, right? LGBT people serving in the Ukrainian military are now the front leaders of the LGBT struggle for visibility and new legislative initiatives. So you might know that the law project on civil partnership started actually moving towards parliament and parliament committees after the petition wrote on behalf of LGBT warriors that they want a civil partnership. And all the attempts that actually took place for previous, I guess, 10 years wasn't that successful until LGBT warriors actually demanded this right. And there are other lines of differentiation between a good and bad sexual citizenship, and they were probably mild 5 years ago, but now they are very, very strong and radically polarized. For example, on the basis of language, migration status, you are a migrant or you are a citizen, or contribution to the military defense, and so on. And also the gender-based restriction of mobility put in place by martial law produced a new wave of transphobic violence on the borders. And though those cases were reported and publicized in the media, there is no much space to discuss them, as there is no space to criticize the state and its institutions during the defensive war. So that's another example how good sexual citizens actually do not criticize the state, even if it produces direct violence to some members of the same LGBT plus communities. So it's a very complex situation.
Okay, thank you. You mentioned before the last question that you work on postcolonial and decolonial studies. Maybe you want to tell us something more about these ideas and how are you working with this in respect to Ukraine?
Right. Yes, I will answer this question in a minute. I just want to add something to the previous question. I hope you don't mind. You remember when I described my research in 2017, I said that there was a mainstream discourse of sexual citizenship, but there were also counter-narratives with critical ideas produced from inside communities by ordinary, so in quotation mark, community members, and so on. And another result of the full-scale war is that those counter-discourses are not possible anymore. So they disappeared from public space, from semi-public space of, I don't know, Facebook discussions or LGBT events. So it's like another effect of this polarization. So I would say the discourse was more plural or like complex before the big war, and now it becomes like very monolithic, very mainstream monolithic, and kind of not allowing the alternative opinions to be voiced and heard. Okay, post-colonial and decolonial. So I told you already that I felt a need to change a perspective and to differentiate between, you know, good sexual citizenship in Ukraine in comparison with other state nations that, you know, are imperial formations or belong to global north. So the situation of Ukraine matters, right? And I also would like to stress once again that I do this part of research with my co-author Maria Majerczyk. So we are a tandem of researchers. We started our search for a theoretical framework already after the Euromaidan events. We looked at how feminism in Ukraine was changing quite rapidly, and we sought to theorize those changes to understand them. And first, we used postcolonial studies. We referred to books by Leela Gandhi, Edward Said, and other postcolonial scholars. It helped us to understand some moments, but not all. And then we discovered the decolonial option. This is a specific epistemic tradition coined in Latin America and Caribbean regions. The central concept of the decolonial option is coloniality. According to the definition by Anibal Quijano, a Chilean thinker, which we cite quite often in our publications, coloniality is a power that stems from colonialism. But while colonialism as a political system has ended, coloniality continues ruling the contemporary world. And it can be identified in several domains: the coloniality of knowledge, coloniality of subjectivities, including gender, sexuality, coloniality of economy, etc. Importantly, there is already a cohort of scholars who study Central and Eastern Europe from a decolonial perspective. We are not the first here, and we are very inspired by this scholarship and offer our own contribution to it as well. And one of our concepts, which we invented or coined, is buffer periphery. It captures the experience of territories that constitute a periphery of not only the West-centered world, as in the West, and the rest, it's a quotation from Stuart Hall, postcolonial framework. So that's why postcolonial framework didn't work completely and perfectly to us, because actually this so-called second world or peripheries of Europe are not that much in this framework. That's why... we needed the colonial option to talk about buffer periphery. And buffer periphery is a periphery in relation of to two or more empire formations. And this is the case of Ukraine, which is greatly affected by at least two imperial powers emanating from the global West or generalized West and Russian imperialism. And while acknowledging that there are many Vests, sometimes we receive like criticism, why you are talking about West as something united. Even within European Union, there are so much differences between, different regions. But in this sense, we refer to the West as a project, not a place, as Edouard Glissant put it. And besides, with respect to sexual politics in Ukraine or sexual citizenship in Ukraine, the hegemonic Western attitudes are quite identical and rather unified. So it's like the same, probably, influence. They are grounded in the neoliberal model of sexual citizenship and visibility and advocacy of LGBT rights as a single issue movement. Yeah, and another interesting thing about buffer periphery is that it is particularly difficult and challenging to perform or to do decolonial resistance here, because when the two empire formations compete for control of knowledge or governmentality and subjectivities, you need constant analytical vigilance to avoid the situation when your voice is being seized by one or other colonial discourse. So, for example, when you speak critically about Russia, you sort of collapse with Western discourse. When you speak critically about West, you collapse with Russian imperial discourse. How to find the way to keep in a critical focus both imperial powers simultaneously? That's the main challenge of buffer periphery, because colonial discourses are very much naturalized. They are very much common sense, and it is quite challenging to see the problem, for example, behind the Western discourse of sexual freedoms and liberations. What could be questioned there? Yeah, that's why, yes, we are operating within the colonial framework and try to understand why LGBT activism or feminist activism or all other liberating ideas work in the way they work in Ukraine, and what is the role of global power regimes.
Olya, thank you so much. I think we run out of time, but we hope to have you again here and that you tell us maybe more another time. Thank you. It's bye from me, Tinka, and
Vadim.
And this was our episode with Dr. Olga Plahotnik
about sexual citizenship. I wish you luck with your work, with your searching process.
Thank you. Thank you for good questions and thank you for opportunity to publicize my research.
It was the podcast Punkt.ua,
which is part of the Unipus project at the University of Greifswald,
with Vadim
and Tinka,
supported by the German Federal Ministry of Education and Research.
Join us on the Punkt.ua podcast.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.